That's a bit of a problem because it's a chicken and the egg issue. How can you increase student performance when you don't have enough money to heat schools?
In the discussion about increasing education funding, some lawmakers say they want it tied to improved outcomes. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, January 11th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, the EPA says a plan to improve air quality in Fairbanks falls short of requirements.
We think that the plan will make progress, but it will not bring the area into compliance.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Sneezing, aching, sweating, and coughing. Who has the time for this misery? You have the power to protect yourself and your community. Boost your defenses this season by getting the flu vaccine. Protect yourself and family. Learn more at vaccinate.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
Recently fired Anchorage Municipal Manager Amy Domboski is accusing Anchorage Mayor Dave Bronson of breaking city and state laws, creating a hostile work environment and other unethical behavior in a scathing letter released today. Bronson abruptly fired Domboski last month after she served in one of the city's top jobs for a year and a half. The 11-page letter to city leaders says the firing was retaliatory and unlawful. In the letter, Domboski's attorney Scott Kendall says Bronson slandered Domboski to municipal staff and attempted to coerce other employees to do the same. The letter also lists a series of, quote, legal and ethical lapses in Bronson's tenure. The allegations include that the mayor directed several contracts to advisor Larry Baker without approval of the assembly or the municipal manager, unlawfully turning off the city's water fluoridation, and directing work on the proposed East Anchorage shelter without assembly approval. Kendall also detailed an instance where Bronson allegedly attempted to have domestic violence charges against Baker's business partner dropped, and that during a separate incident, Bronson brought a firearm to Baker's home as police responded to a domestic disturbance there. The letter also describes numerous instances of sexist actions from the mayor and senior staff that amounted to gender discrimination. Kendall ended the letter with a request for Bronson to contact Domboski's attorneys to reach a settlement and issue a written correction and apology for remarks made about Domboski. Officials with Bronson's office declined to respond to requests for comment about the letter, citing advice from the municipal attorney not to discuss issues related to potential litigation. Anchorage Assembly leaders say they're reviewing the contents of the letter and preparing a formal statement in response. With the start of Alaska's next legislative session right around the corner, many lawmakers are talking about boosting education funding. The baseline funding the state gives to school districts, known as the Base Student Allocation, or BSA, has essentially not changed since 2017. At the same time, the cost of pretty much everything has gone up, and districts are facing severe budget shortfalls and wrestling with difficult decisions, like closing schools, eliminating positions, and increasing class sizes. So, as the Anchorage Daily News reports, some legislators say it's a major priority to get more money to the schools. ADN reporter Iris Samuels has been talking to lawmakers who want to increase the BSA, and Samuels says the two main questions are by how much and what strings will be attached.
So, from conversations I've had in recent days, it sounds like it's a really high priority across the political spectrum, and maybe that's a difference this year compared to previous years, because there have been some legislators that have been prioritizing this, have been talking about it for several years now. What's different now is that more conservative lawmakers, lawmakers that are less eager to spend public dollars in any given year, are now acknowledging how important this issue is. But different lawmakers are talking about this differently. And I hear from more Democrats just a willingness to increase funding and to get it so that districts feel whole and they feel like they can provide the services that they need. For more conservative lawmakers, they're more likely to be talking about this in terms of student achievement as well. And Alaska ranks pretty low in some key metrics in terms of student performance in both reading and math, and that's been the case for years. And some lawmakers are talking about how can we increase the formula, increase the funding that schools get, but make sure that that increase is tied to some metrics to ensure that education quality rises with this increase. That's a bit of a problem because it's a chicken and the egg issue. How can you increase student performance when you don't have enough money to heat schools?
Right. Yeah, definitely a chicken and egg kind of situation. And it seems like when you talk about that change in who is talking about this, it made me think of a quote that was in your story about, you know, people have talked about this being a problem in the past, but now this is happening in my backyard. And, you know, I think that's kind of a reference to some of the schools that are here on the road system, especially in Anchorage. They're talking about having to close some schools to make up that budget gap. And it seems to get to your point of, the conversation hasn't changed. It's just who's having that conversation seems to have changed a little bit, right?
Right. And I think that the nature of the problem itself has become more acute with time because there were a few things that happened in recent years that allowed school districts across the state to account for lower state funding with other sources. So the federal government had increases to school funding tied to the pandemic. And districts have been using that money and been trying to stretch those dollars, but that money has now run out. So a problem that was a little bit masked, there was kind of a Band-Aid over it, has now been exposed fully. And now we're seeing everything that's been happening under that Band-Aid for a couple years.
Right. Yeah, the Band-Aid's off and now it's a major priority
right
for the legislature. Well, you know, I guess the last year or two might explain part of this in terms of that pandemic funding from the federal government. But I mean, we're talking about going back to 2017 pre-pandemic. So why hasn't this happened already? I mean, what are the roadblocks that have prevented lawmakers who want to increase education funding from actually doing that?
It's a complex issue, but really it comes down to the fiscal challenges that Alaska has been facing for several years now. It's just a matter of some lawmakers see that the state's resources, the money that the state has to give out to all the different services that the state offers, that amount is not where it needs to be. And the state had a big deficit. And so both Governor Dunleavy and some lawmakers basically said, you know, even if we want to make these increases, we just don't have the money to do it.
And then there are also some lawmakers who have said they, quote, don't want to write a blank check without those returns in the form of better test scores, right? Is that still a roadblock? Are people still talking about that? And then I guess side question, you know, how do they even measure that? Is it test scores? Is it GPAs? How does that work?
So that's a good question. And I think we'll see a lot of conversations around that in the coming legislative session. I think that some lawmakers might be saying now that they see the importance of increasing funding to schools, but they're still kind of tied up on this issue of making sure that that funding is tied to better performances from the schools. The question is, how do you make that connection? It is sort of this open thing of, do you use test scores? Do you use other metrics? And it's not by chance that even though legislators are saying now that they really are prioritizing increasing the base student allocation, we haven't actually seen particular bills that will do that because legislators are still kind of working out the mechanisms to do that. And I think that there will be several different proposals and the session will be several months long and we'll probably see a lot of evolution there.
Yeah, I anticipate more stories about this to come, right?
Without a doubt.
Okay, Iris, as much as anyone can predict what the legislature is going to do, what do you think is going to happen?
I would put the likelihood of funding increasing very, very high. The question is just by how much and what kind of stipulations will be attached to that funding increase. So I'm not a person who will bet money on anything, but I do think that people can have confidence there will be a funding increase how that increase comes, how big it'll be, will have a huge impact on what districts can actually do with that funding increase moving forward.
That was Anchorage Daily News reporter Iris Samuels. You can find her full story written with her colleague Morgan Krakow at ADN.com. The Republican who lost an Anchorage House race in November has appealed a judge's ruling that found that Democrat Jennifer Jenny Armstrong met residency requirements to take office and accepted Armstrong as the winner. Republican Liz Vasquez and four others filed an appeal of Superior Court Judge Herman Walker Jr.'s decision on Tuesday. The Alaska Supreme Court plans to hear arguments on Friday. Walker issued his ruling Monday after hearing the case in late December. The new legislature convenes next week. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, remembering the legacy of North Slope legend Oliver Levitt.
In order to do the things that he had to do, he had to work hard. He practically camped in Washington, D.C.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Annie Wright Schools, located in Tacoma, Washington, offers rich, thoughtful, and internationally recognized programs for students from around the world. A variety of boarding options are available year-round. There's a virtual preview of the school, the faculty, and campus for high school students seeking to explore international baccalaureate academics, arts, and athletics at aw.org/Alaska. This message sponsored by Annie Wright Schools.
The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is proposing to reject portions of a state plan to reduce Fairbanks and North Pole area wintertime fine particulate pollution. It's the latest step in a 14-year struggle to rein in emissions linked to serious health problems. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The Fairbanks North Pole area was designated as having a fine particulate pollution problem back in 2009 after the EPA tightened the air quality standard based on studies that linked breathing the tiny particles from combustion of wood, coal, and oil to health impacts, including premature death among those with heart or lung disease. Pollution reduction programs have lowered local fine particulate, or PM2.5, levels 50% since 2015, and the state must have a plan to cut them in half again to achieve the federal health standard by an October 2025 deadline.
We think that the plan will make progress, but it will not bring the area into compliance.
EPA Region 10 spokesperson Bill Dunbar says the latest State Implementation Plan, or SIP, addresses wood smoke pollution, but falls short when it comes to sulfur dioxide emissions from coal and oil-fired power plants and boilers.
Many of those plants don't have any emission controls at all, or the emission controls they have are sort of rudimentary.
Dunbar says the EPA wants reconsideration of power plant emissions controls, as well as a switch to cleaner burning but more expensive ultra-low sulfur diesel for heating fuel.
The state indicated that it was not feasible or economic to install what we call the best available control technology. And then the same thing with ultra-low sulfur diesel. The state has indicated that they feel that ultra-low sulfur diesel is not available and not affordable, and EPA needs to see a better analysis.
We don't think the cost proposals that EPA is putting forward are correct, where we know the major issue is wood smoke.
Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation Air Quality Director Jason Olds says the state will defend its plan.
We think we have an avenue and an argument that's supported by good science for why we should be able to keep the plan that we put forward and not implement both of those measures.
The DEC attributes nearly 90% of local PM2.5 pollution to wood-burning emissions. EPA grants have funded Fairbanks North Star Borough replacement of thousands of wood stoves with models certified as cleaner burning under an agency testing program the state found in 2021 to be easily manipulated, resulting in artificially low manufacturer emissions data.
It suggests that we would be able to get better emissions reductions, an easier time getting to attainment than what is actually occurring.
Olds questions the EPA's proposed rejection of parts of the SIP when the federal agency failed on a key tool to address the primary source of local emissions. A 60-day public comment period is underway on the EPA's proposed actions, and the agency plans to hold a public meeting in Fairbanks next month. Meanwhile, a federal judge ruled January 9th that the state can intervene in a lawsuit filed by the Fairbanks group Citizens for Clean Air against the EPA to force the federal agency to accept or reject the state implementation plan after missing a June 22 deadline to do so. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Trollers turned out at the Sitka Assembly meeting last night to voice concerns about a court case that could shut down commercial salmon trolling in southeast Alaska. The lawsuit is about Washington killer whales and Alaska king salmon. Fishermen and representatives from the Alaska Trollers Association asked the local assembly to consider contributing $25,000 to their legal defense fund. KCAW's Catherine Rose reports.
The Seattle-based environmental group Wild Fish Conservancy wants to stop the southeast troll fisheries, which they say harm an endangered population of orcas. The group has argued the government failed to adequately address the impact of Alaska's king salmon harvests on southern resident killer whales, whose population in the Puget Sound area of Washington has dropped to critically low levels. And in December, a federal judge in Washington issued a report that puts the fisheries at risk of closure. The Alaska Trollers Association is a defendant in the 2020 suit against the National Marine Fisheries Service. Sitka fisherman Matt Donahoe is the president of the Trollers Group. He says they object to the report and expect their legal expenses to increase.
Anyone claiming that southern resident killer whales are starving because Alaska trollers were taking food from the mouth of their babies would be laughed out of court. That's what we thought. Yet a judge is recommending that the historic southeast Alaska troll fishery, which for 100 years has never closed, will shut down this winter. If that happens, the industry will die, and so will a large part of southeast Alaska's economy.
Around a dozen fishermen asked the assembly to help with the organization's legal defense fund. And it's not just trollers. Linda Benkin leads the Alaska Longline Fishermen's Association. Both her group and the trollers drafted a report outlining research into the decline of southern resident orcas. She said the lawsuit ignores a large body of science, which indicates that pollution, not fisheries, are the biggest threat.
They're struggling with habitat issues. They're struggling with what's been done in the world around them. They're in Puget Sound. It's not even fisheries, let alone the fisheries 1,000 miles away up here.
When it came time for the assembly to consider the proposal, there was support, and some said they'd be interested in giving more than $25,000. Assemblymember Chris Yested, who's a fisherman himself, said he saw it as an investment.
I think the Sitka troll fleet produces more than $25,000 in tax revenue every year to the city, so I don't think it's too much for them to ask for some of it back to fight their battles.
Assemblymember Crystal Duncan suggested calling for other southeast communities to throw in money.
I'm just wondering if this is a southeast-wide problem. Rather than us take and elevate that number beyond 25,000, I guess the question is, have we reached out to say, here's what has happened since, here's how much we're requesting of Sitka, can you match that?
But Duncan also wondered whether the assembly would be setting a precedent that would lead other industry groups to request money to help with legal fees. Sponsor Tor Christensen didn't take issue with that.
I am hard-pressed to think of an event that has threatened to wipe out a huge portion of our economy in one fell swoop. In my mind, that is a definition of emergency. So if somebody came forward with a similar issue, yes, we would discuss it.
And then there was a question of where the money should come from. City Administrator John Leach and Municipal Attorney Brian Hansen said the Fisheries Enhancement Fund could likely be used, but Mayor Steven Eisenbeiss preferred the money come from the city's general fund. As for whether the assembly could offer more than $25,000, Eisenbeiss noted that while no one at the meeting spoke against the measure, the assembly had received some pushback in their inbox.
I didn't expect that, but it's for better or for worse what we saw. So I think we should start here, and then as things develop, keep an eye and a pulse on that.
The Sitka Assembly didn't take a vote at the meeting. Assembly members Christensen and Kevin Mosier, who co-sponsored the discussion item, said they'd bring an ordinance to the table for the Assembly to vote on at the next regular meeting, January 24th. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Catherine Rose.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Alaska chapter of the American Physical Therapy Association mission is to enhance the movement, health, and wellness in the communities where practitioners live and serve. Life's pleasures and richness of experience frequently relate directly to the ability to move without pain or limitation. To promote physical therapy access for all Alaskans, sessions are offered on Saturdays at no charge for those with financial barriers to care. More at APTAalaska.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Physical Therapy Association.
The State Department of Transportation is changing the leadership running the Alaska Marine Highway System. As Angela Denning with Coast Alaska reports, the manager of the ferry system is leaving after almost 20 years, and there's a new deputy commissioner.
The Alaska Marine Highway Operating Board addressed the staffing changes at a January 6th meeting. Shirley Marcourt is board president.
The system is in a really vulnerable place right now. So, you know, in terms of talking about planning for succession and transition, how does that work?
Here's DOT Commissioner Ryan Anderson at the meeting.
I really recognize there's a lot of change going on right now, and that's a serious thing.
The Marine Highway System's general manager of nearly 20 years, Captain John Falvey, announced his retirement. His last day will be January 17th. Commissioner Anderson said they will be aggressively looking for Falvey's replacement over the next month through a national search. They didn't have an advertisement ready at the time of the board meeting.
Something we have to, you know, put the energy into and make sure we're all working together, that we have good lines of communication. And we're all just solid on, we have a purpose here, and that's, you know, keeping the system moving, keeping Alaska moving.
The state named Captain Tony Carvalis interim manager. He's currently the ferry system's operations manager. Retiring Captain Falvey served through five administrations. He was appointed as AMHS general manager in 2004 by Governor Frank Murkowski. Before that, Falvey worked for 27 years in commercial shipbuilding and in ocean-class vessel and fast ferry operations, including crew management. He graduated from the Maine Maritime Academy in 1976. No one from the state would comment on Falvey's tenure when asked several times by Coast Alaska, but Anderson spoke about him briefly at the board meeting.
I want to thank Captain Falvey for his service. He's a vast, you know, knowledgeable man that I respect.
Board Vice President Juanetta Ayers said Falvey will be remembered.
He really has done a yeoman's job for Alaska and for Alaskans and for the Alaska Marine Highway.
Again, Board President Marcourt.
He worked through quite a bit of financial and political chaos, which is normal. Everyone has to do it, but he did that for 20 years. Your time at AMHS is greatly appreciated by thousands and thousands of Alaskans.
Falvey did not return emails and calls requesting comment. But at the ferry board meeting, he thanked all of the marine highway workers.
It takes a team to keep this operation moving. It is very, very complex. And it's something that the person riding in this office, just they can't do that by themselves. And that is the ship's crews, the folks here in KCO, the folks out in the terminals. It takes a real team pulling together to make it all go.
The Department of Transportation, which oversees the Marine Highway, also has a new deputy commissioner. Rob Carpenter resigned at the end of the year and was replaced by Catherine Keith on January 5th. She previously served as the liaison for the ferry board. Keith told the board she's optimistic about the future.
I think we're at a time where we just want to look forward, and that the situation that we're in is dynamic and things are happening in real time pretty quickly.
Robert Venables, director of the Regional Civic and Business Organization Southeast Conference, has worked with Falvey for 18 years. He said he will be a very tough act to follow. Board member Ayers says she hopes Falvey would share suggestions on managing the Marine Highway System and the specific skills needed for his replacement before he leaves for good January 17th. In Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
Alaskans are mourning the loss of a North Slope leader who grew up running sled dog teams to collect firewood along the Arctic coast and came of age in the time of snow machines, borough governments, and native corporations. Oliver Levitt died Sunday at the age of 79. KNBA's Rhonda McBride looks at his life and legacy.
Oliver Levitt was a whaling captain and a cultural beacon for his people, fluent in Inupiaq, and known for his ability to make skin whaling boats without a blueprint.
Without a piece of paper in your hand to go from dimensional wood, hardwoods, and end up with a whaling boat is a skill.
Richard Glenn says Levitt was his mentor at the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, where they served together on the board and in management roles. Glenn says he admired Levitt for his ability to fight for the region and to move comfortably from the boardroom to the whaling camp to the halls of Washington, D.C.
He was adept at it. He made it effortless. He has a diplomat skill, but he also has a hard-won, nuts-and-bolts kind of education.
An education Levitt used to help turn ASRC into Alaska's largest private company.
Well, we've known each other for, I think, over 50 years.
Willie Hensley, a leader in Alaska's native land claims fight, first met Oliver Levitt when he got out of the Army. And it was then, he said, that Levitt dedicated himself to a life of public service, working to form a new borough, teaming up with other leaders to turn ASRC into a company that today earns billions in revenues every year.
He was persistent, and in order to do the things that he had to do, he had to work hard. He practically camped in Washington, D.C.
Hensley says one of Levitt's biggest accomplishments was his battle to help the North Slope Borough gain access to a gas field controlled by the U.S. Navy. This enabled the borough to bring heat and power to the region. Although Hensley was from Kotzebue, a community on the northwest coast of Alaska, he says the two men bonded over their upbringing, growing up in a time when there were no modern amenities, just lots of hard work.
The reason we're good friends is because I understood exactly what he was saying.
Hensley says Levitt was passionate about improving life in the Arctic, and although the two didn't always agree on how to do this, their friendship endured. Hensley was at Levitt's side to offer comfort when he died in his home village of Utqiagvik, surrounded by loved ones. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
A memorial for Levitt is planned for 1 p.m. on Monday in Utqiagvik at the Barrow High School. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Wesley Early and Rhonda McBride in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Catherine Rose in Sitka, and Angela Denning in Petersburg. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer tonight is Tobin Shelby, Madeline Rose is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Thanks for listening today. We love being a part of your media mix. Tune in every day to catch the best in statewide news and programming. From one end of Alaska to the other and everywhere in between, public media works to provide quality programming and statewide news you can count on and news you can trust. Whether you're listening at home, at work, or in the car, we're grateful to be a part of your day. Thank you for tuning in. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.